Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, June 22nd, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
The U.S. Supreme Court is racing towards its summer recess, but before the justices leave town, they have to decide cases that could reshape American government for decades. Can a president end birthright citizenship with the stroke of a pen? Can the White House fire officials at independent agencies designed to operate outside of partisan politics? And should states be allowed to count mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day? These are just some of the questions that the Roberts Court will decide at this very pivotal moment. We'll examine the biggest decisions still yet to come, what they could mean for executive power, immigration, elections, and civil rights, and a whole lot more. We've got two great guests. We have Emily Bazelon from New York Times Magazine and Josh Gerstein of Politico. And of course, we would love to hear from you, our listeners. Our questions of the day are this: what cases are you most concerned about or invested in? Or what do you think the most consequential cases are? And you can give us your why as well. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you could put your comments in the chat. And Kevin, this is a pretty big deal. The birthright citizenship case, especially. Yeah. A lot of people talking about that online. Supreme Court has been making some very monumental decisions during the entire Trump administration.
Yeah, and always a flurry of activity in the news here at the end of June. Yeah. Around the Supreme Court. And so, instead of being blindsided when the headline comes out, we wanted to have a show today where we could unpack all these cases.
Think it through.
So you had some idea of, you know, what's to come in the next 10 days or so. So like you said, there's a lot of interesting cases here, a lot of things hanging in the balance. Excited to unpack it all today on the show. But first, a trio of local news stories. Story number one, Immigration and Customs Enforcement is doing an about-face on its ramp-up of warehouse detention centers. Mm-hmm. So you might remember under previous Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, the Trump administration spent about $1 billion on 11 warehouse facilities that it was planning to use to detain undocumented migrants. Now, two of those were in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and another in New Jersey. And now the New York Times reports that ICE is planning to offload 7 of those warehouses across the country that mm-hmm. it purchased for $700 million, selling them, transferring to other federal agencies. And that does include the 3 in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So locally, you know, Democratic elected officials have been against the warehouses. Mm-hmm. You had Josh Shapiro, Pennsylvania governor, say he would aggressively pursue every option to prevent the facilities that were slated for Berks County and Schuylkill County. And you had New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill and Attorney General Jennifer Davenport filing a joint lawsuit in March in an effort to stop the site in New Jersey. And behind the scenes, it seems like there's a shift here in strategy, Cherry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the warehouse strategy was supposed to allow the administration to quickly upscale its mass deportation efforts. You can't take in or detain tens of thousands of people and deport them without having a safe, clean place to take them. So this downshift in warehouses raises a lot of questions about whether this administration can remain as aggressive when it comes to ICE enforcement. And, you have in the notes here that Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen has said that, you know, they're going to be focused on the worst of the worst. But that hadn't been the case under the previous secretary. So but the other thing that it raises questions about is why this administration would have spent so much money buying these specific warehouses as well, because there had been some environmental concerns, mm-hmm. lots of lawsuits filed, you know, because of the locations of where they were putting these warehouses. And so there's just been a lot of pushback. And you mentioned in Pennsylvania, these municipal, governments have been pushing back. You had the governor in both New Jersey and Pennsylvania push back. And this wasn't just here. Right. This was all over the country.
And how much of this is an optics thing versus a real policy change per se? Because I think what Mark Wayne Mullen, the new secretary, is kind of saying is twofold. Like, we don't need the scrutiny around housing all these people in these different states where you're going to get pushback, and it's happening on American soil at American tax dollar expense, versus what he seems to be saying is getting them out of the country as fast as possible. So at the end of the day, how many people are deported or not based on this policy shift? Like that's not clear that just because they're downshifting this plan, it means it's going to be any less deportation. It's just a different strategy in how to deal with people in the interim.
It just makes you wonder what kind of due process folks are going to get.
And there's that too.
Lots of questions. So second story, Rutgers University dropped a new study that found that there are mutant rodents living in northeast urban areas. Yes, mutant rodents. According to this study, Rutgers studied mice from Philly, Manhattan, Trenton, and a few nearby suburbs, and found that 70% of those mice had a mutant gene that makes them resistant to rodent poisons. Compare that to just 35% of mice found in other places like Norway. So the mice around here, more mutant than in other places. The experts say this shows that mice in northeastern U.S. urban areas have evolved to survive common poisons. And now when it comes to rats, apparently the rats haven't evolved genetically, but they have gotten smarter. Researchers say that they have become so sophisticated that they can outsmart and evade traps entirely. They will avoid new objects, including live traps, and they learn from every single encounter. Shout out to the Philadelphia Inquirer for this story, but the lead authors took on this research because frustrated pest control companies said, look, we're giving multiple, you know, treatments, and these mice, they're not dying, man. They're coming back stronger. And they wondered why. Well, it's because they're mutants.
Well, anecdotally, I can say that, you know, we used to have a mouse issue in my house, and we had an exterminator come through, and it just seemed like they're putting all this poison out, and I'm still seeing evidence. And we got to the point where we got a cat, and the cat has taken care of the issue completely, which is awesome.
Nothing beats a cat.
But in that interim period, yeah, it was so frustrating because you're paying the exterminator, and it doesn't seem like the poison's doing anything.
Yeah, and you know, you get it. Like, they've evolved. They've gotten smarter. I mean, you know, survival of the fittest, right? So these mice and these rats, and the rats are so smart. I mean, they're just, you put out a trap and they're just like, we're not going over there.
Yeah. So there's teenage mutant ninja mice. Is that what you're
telling
me? That's
what I'm telling you, according to Rutgers, man. So, I mean, these pest control companies, they're telling them, y'all got to come up with better strategies. All right. Pivot. It's a pivot moment
for
you guys.
All right, story number three. World Cup excitement continues. And if you're bopping around South Philly today, Mbappe mania will be unavoidable. Mm-hmm. Yes, the worldwide soccer megastar Kylian Mbappe will lead France against Iraq at 5 p.m. down at Philadelphia Stadium tonight, a.k.a. The Link. But, Cherry, meteorologists are warning of severe thunderstorms.
Oh,
and
no.
FIFA will pause or postpone the game if lightning is detected within 8 miles of the stadium. So you have to have 30 free minutes of no lightning to be able to get that game going again. And we also had to shout out this very fun write-up by Alex Coffey in The Inquirer about these four French friends who came to Philly for this game and are currently having their own Ferris Bueller experience around the city. This is a trip, Cherry, organized by a Parisian waiter and his buddies. They saved money for years to be able to make this trip, but couldn't get the time off of work officially. So they came up with some sort of lie to tell their bosses, who apparently don't know that they're out of the country and plan to be out of the country through the 4th of July. I don't know what this lie is, Cherry.
Well, they can't tell you the lie because then that would get them in trouble because then you know who they are. But
it's another one of these examples, though, of like we're seeing all these heartwarming stories of international tourists seeing the country or seeing Philadelphia through fresh eyes, right? So you have these guys walking around the city and they're like, we had what you call that cheese whiz. It's not cheese, but it was good anyway.
And they're eating hoagies and they're having a ball. And they, like many other tourists, have discovered ranch dressing.
Ranch dressing, right? And apparently this is like a thing now where these international tourists come, they discover ranch for the first time, they love it. And apparently they've been trying to put it in their carry-on bag at the airport, and the TSA sent out a note that said, if you're visiting for a very large sporting event and you happen to discover ranch while you're here, please pack it in your checked bag on your way home. So the TSA had to chime in about ranch.
People are going crazy over ranch dressing. And shout out to Kraft, because they made a TSA compliant ranch packet for folks so they could take massive amounts of ranch dressing back to their home countries. By the way, I love ranch. I put it on everything, salads, veggies, you know, sandwiches. And I love to dip all sorts of like hand proteins in there. Like
absolutely
nuggets.
Not. Absolutely not.
I
Cherry.
Love them.
This was a divide on the staff this morning. It's gross. Ranch is gross.
Ranch is delicious. I'm just joking. But another thing we'll be talking about when we come back here is the U.S. Supreme Court. Not delicious, but still something worth talking about. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. My co-host Avi Wolfman-Arendt is off today. The U.S. Supreme Court traditionally ends its term before the July 4th holiday and doesn't return until the fall. So, in the weeks leading up to their break, we get a flurry of decisions handed down. And this year is no exception. There are still more than a dozen opinions left to be released, and some are big ones. We're waiting on rulings about whether President Trump can deny birthright citizenship to children born on U.S. soil if their parents came here illegally, and whether he can fire officials from independent agencies. And there are a bunch of other major cases involving transgender sports bans, late arriving mail-in ballots, campaign finance limits, and asylum seekers. We have two great guests to help us walk through the Supreme Court docket, the legal arguments, and how the justices are likely to rule. First, we have Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at Yale Law School. Emily, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much, Cherry. Love being here.
Yes. And we also have Josh Gerstein, legal affairs correspondent for Politico. Josh, thanks for being here.
Hey, Cherry. Good to be with you.
Yes, and we'd love to hear from you, our listeners, on the road, at home, elsewhere. Our questions of the day: what cases are you most concerned about or invested in, or what do you think the most consequential cases are? And you can give us your why. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put your comments in the live chat. And so I kind of wanted to level set, Emily and Josh, because before the court hands down its final decisions, we already have a pretty good sense of the major themes of this term. The justices have ruled on tariffs, voting rights, gun rights, conversion therapy, and the list goes on. And so before we talk about what's left, what has this Supreme Court term already told us about this court? Emily, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, first of all, this is a deeply conservative majority, and I think we have plenty of evidence of that. And the big questions of this term largely turn on executive authority. We have a president who is taking power for himself and the executive branch in a way that, you know, sometimes there's no precedent for, sometimes you can maybe think of a prior example, but the degree that Trump is doing that is still in its own category. And so then that puts pressure on the Supreme Court as an independent branch of government to make sure that the president is following the law. And sometimes that means basically standing up for Congress, going back to the text of a law Congress has passed and make sure that the president is following what Congress intended. And sometimes it has meant asserting a role for the Supreme Court and for the lower courts. And I think the court has had a mixed record in standing up to Trump's power grabs, and we can for sure talk about that. And then the voting rights decision is, I think, in a kind of different category, mm-hmm. where the court in that case is really, I would argue, undermining congressional intent and really changing what the political map looks like in terms of gerrymandering in a way that is in line with conservative principles and also benefits Republicans.
Yeah. So we have, on one hand, we have this executive authority question. On the other hand, we have the court that seems to be undermining congressional authority. Josh, I want to get your input on what you see as the major themes. You agree with Emily here.
Yeah, I agree totally with Emily. And I also think one other thing we're looking at this year is sort of the contrast with the year before. We're in the second year of the Trump administration. During the first year of the Trump administration, we had a lot of the matters of executive power that Emily's alluding to come to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis for emergency decisions. A lot of those came down along ideological lines, which on the current court is a 6-3 ruling. The conservatives have a big advantage, and people should also keep in mind that a full half of those conservatives, three of them, were appointed by President Trump himself. So that's another factor out there in terms of his influence on the court. And what we're looking at this year, after last year, where the president was very, very successful in defending his power assertions at the court, I think there's different ways of calculating it, but among the cases that the court took up last year on emergency basis, the administration won somewhere around 80% of them, and some of the other ones came to a more muddled result. Many, many high-profile disputes over firing hundreds of thousands of federal employees, over literally billions of dollars in cuts that were implemented by DOGE, very successful in that area, came up short a little bit on some issues related to immigration of, alien use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport people, but in other areas, they're kind of deportations of people to, say, third countries overseas. That was allowed to go forward. And now we're seeing many of those cases come back to the court on a more routine basis for a deeper look from the justices. And what we're looking for is, does that come out any different? Does the sort of hurried decisions of last year play out any differently this year? Does the court that seemed very tolerant of Trump's power assertions last year put more restraints on him in the decisions this year? And we're seeing a little bit of a trend in that direction. It's not a huge trend, but it does look like the needle has moved a little bit against the president in some areas. Probably the biggest decision, could be the
Tariffs.
biggest decision of the year, would be the tariffs decision that already came down against him and has really caused him to be quite angry at the court.
Yeah, and Emily, you had mentioned the record of this court. When you look at it, I mean, we and I think Josh pointed this out, that there was this emergency docket that was happening, and the president and his administration was by far winning. But this time, the court is taking a deeper look. Your thoughts on the record thus far? And of course, there's still a large number of cases that still need to be decided over the next few days.
Well, tariffs obviously is the most important way that the Supreme Court has differed with President Trump. And look, it's a big deal for any court to say no to a president's signature executive order. At the same time, I think it's important to remember that Trump was interpreting the law that he was using to enact these tariffs in a way that no president had done before. And so sometimes I think it's important to remember the context. This is going to be true also for birthright citizenship, where Trump is claiming that with a stroke of his pen, he can erase a right that I think by almost consensus is viewed to be part of the 14th Amendment. That is how the 14th Amendment has been interpreted ever since it was written. The congressional intent there seems clear. And so, in a sense, you can say, like, okay, yes, the Supreme Court is standing up to the president, but it's also in this context in which the president is defying the law, and the court almost doesn't really have a choice. So, I feel like it's important to kind of factor that in to how we're viewing the court. And then, as Josh was saying, there have been decision after decision on the emergency docket and some on the merits docket in which the court has very much gone along with big moves the president has made, to effectively dismantle the Department of Education, to effectively end U.S. aid abroad, even though Congress had appropriated those funds. I could go on with other examples. And so, you just want to think about all of those decisions when you're evaluating the court's record.
Yeah, and I want to, before we start digging into the cases that are left on the list to be decided, I want to sort of this court. There's been a growing distrust among the public, seeing the court as partisan. And because we have six justices that are a conservative, several that have been selected and handpicked by this president and have been, sort of ruling in his favor repeatedly. I want to sort of get your thoughts. Has this court sort of been very partisan? Have there been moments where you were surprised by decisions of individual justices as we look to sort of foreshadow what is to come? And Josh, I'll let you take this one first.
Well, I mean, I do think that the court has tended to make decisions that favor Republicans on issues that are of major political concern. So, like Emily was alluding to earlier, if we look at like the voting rights cases, the court has tended to do that and has tended to do it more and more strongly as the conservatives have gotten a larger majority. I don't see that as really a Trump-related phenomenon, although he did manage to get three appointees to the court and put in three staunchly conservative justices. That is more of a project that we've seen going on for 20 or 30 years. Chief Justice John Roberts has been acutely interested in these voting rights issues and has voted fairly consistently, not 100% consistently, to move the court away from enforcement of the Voting Rights Act over the last several decades. So it's something that we've seen play out under the Trump administration, and it does give rise to these feelings of partisanship. I would say one other thing on that front is you do get those kinds of complaints from the liberal members of the court that they're treating everything that the Trump administration wants to do as an emergency, and that there's essentially a finger on the scale that says that if the administration wants to accomplish something, that's the kind of emergency kind of harm that's being created to the president's agenda that requires the court's intervention. And that's not always the way the Supreme Court has approached these kinds of things. Maybe it has in the area of national security, but in the areas of domestic policy, like Emily was mentioning, dismantling the education department and things along those lines, in the past, the court has been pretty much leaning towards what Congress wanted to do in those areas. And here they're saying if any Trump executive order is frustrated for a day, that's the kind of harm where courts may need to intervene.
Wow. Your thoughts on that, Emily? Have you any surprises from this court? Does it seem, or does it seem like they just fall in line, along the ideological lines?
Well, just to back up a little more of what Josh was saying, I think there's good evidence that the court did not necessarily treat as an emergency all the petitions from the Biden administration in the same way that it has for the Trump administration. And so, when Americans see, when Americans view the court as partisan, that may be part of what is filtering through to them. And I think there's also a hangover still from Dobbs, which was the decision that overturned Roe versus Wade and ended the national constitutional right to abortion. You see a dip in public approval ratings and in people's view of the court as a legitimate, nonpartisan branch of government. So, those are some of the hits that the court has taken. That doesn't mean that it's always the 6-3 ideological split. Sometimes we do see the justices line up differently. It does not, however, tend to be in the most headline-making, big-deal cases that really affect Americans' lives in a way that they can feel. And so I think, again, that sort of factors into this impression of the court as being partisan, which we should say the justices, when they make personal appearances, they do their utmost to try to say, no, we're colleagues here, we're friends, we have institutional legitimacy. So they are really backing away from this idea, even though there are a whole bunch of data points that explain why Americans have this view.
Yeah, and they have tried that. All the different justices went out on their different book tours and talking tours, and all of them tried to talk about how they are friends and how they work together and that lots of collegiality among the justices. By the way, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What cases are you most concerned about or interested in? or what do you think the most consequential cases are? And you can give us your why. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Going to read a couple comments. NYC215 on YouTube says, what I am most concerned with or find to be very consequential is the Supreme Court case about mail-in ballots and birthright citizenship. I believe they want to rig the elections. That's NYC215 on YouTube. And so I wanted to sort of dig in now to the cases that remain on the docket for decisions. And I wanted to start with the Trump versus Barbara case, the birthright citizenship case. You know, Trump's executive order seeks to end automatic citizenship for some children born in the United States. And I wanted to ask you, Josh, why do you think this issue has become such a defining issue for this administration?
Well, I mean, I remember back to 2016 when Trump was beginning his campaign for the White House for his first term. You know, the focus he put on immigration, on illegal immigration, and these sort of over-the-top claims about immigrants that were coming here to commit crimes or were convicted criminals was always part of that. And the other thing that's really interesting about this issue of birthright citizenship, Cherry, is that it goes beyond the issue of illegal immigration to sort of legal immigration. In fact, this executive order targets both the children of people who are in the country illegally, but also children of people that are here in the country legally. And at times we've seen people like Stephen Miller in the White House talk about their concerns about sort of the cultural makeup of America, the ethnic makeup of America. And I see this fight over birthright citizenship going towards that. You have Republicans and Trump supporters, not all Republicans, but some Republicans saying, you know, they're concerned, for example, about Chinese tourism to the U.S., birth tourism, where you have people coming from China who are not U.S. citizens giving birth in the U.S. to try to take advantage of birthright citizenship for their children. And there's then this sort of claim that this is creating a sleeper cell kind of situation that will play out 20 years down the road when those children are free to register to vote, that has to be addressed. And that this issue of being able to get birthright citizenship for your children is a major sort of pull factor that encourages illegal immigration. And so it is, to the extent immigration is at the core of Trump's agenda, which it seems to be, or at least it was until very recently, for him to take on the birthright issue is a very logical one for him to fight over, even though the legal arguments here, I think, are fairly weak.
Yeah. And so pivoting to the legal arguments, you know, Emily, the saying that you want to stop this is one thing, but trying to write an executive order that would basically upend, you know, more than a century of jurisprudence is a different thing. Could you lay out the argument that the Trump administration has made and then the argument against that?
Well, let's just start with the text of the 14th Amendment, which says in its opening sentence, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. We've always, as a country, interpreted that provision to have very broad right to birthright citizenship with some very minor exceptions. And the exceptions were like, you're born here because your parents are fighting in a hostile army, or you're born here, but you're here because your parents were on a diplomatic mission. And so everybody else we viewed as subject to the jurisdiction thereof because they're subject to the laws of the United States, right? Whether you crossed over here illegally or not, once you're here, if you commit a crime, you can get arrested because you're subject to our laws. The Trump administration wants to claim that subject to the jurisdiction thereof is much broader and that people who come here illegally are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. They're in a separate category. They never lose the kind of, quote, alien status that comes with illegal immigration. And so that's really the argument that these people, whether or not they have to abide by American law, don't count in the language of the 14th Amendment. I think, as Josh was saying, this is a weak legal argument. Yeah. There's been, you know, very little support for it over the years. I will say that there have been a few conservative law professors who have come forward and kind of cherry-picked some evidence from the historical record to support this argument. And I also will note that they tend to be law professors who, in the past, did recognize a broader right to birthright citizenship, but kind of see an opportunity here now to try to call it all into question. Maybe that's because they're kind of laying the groundwork for some kind of real legal change. They talk about the Second Amendment in this context, right? Like, nobody really thought the Second Amendment meant that you had to strike down a bunch of gun control laws until all of a sudden they did think that, starting with Supreme Court opinions that date from around 2010, 2014. And then I think, as Josh was saying, and as you were pointing out, this is a political tool as well. It's not necessarily true that birthright citizenship is super popular. And so there's a way in which the Trump administration may see a political advantage here, even if they lose in court, which they're really likely to when this decision from the Supreme Court comes down.
And do you predict as well, Josh, because Emily's saying very likely they will lose, your thoughts as well, despite the fact that the president showed up to oral arguments, which is very unusual for a sitting president to show up at the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you predict that this will also be a loss for the Trump administration?
I mean, that's the consensus at the moment. And even Trump himself has said in some of his social media posts in the last few weeks and months that he thinks he's going to come up on the short end of the arguments. I think that, the argument on the language is actually maybe a little better than Emily has suggested. I think it might be a little stronger. But the thing that I think is determinative here is that, it's very obvious that Congress has acted for the last century under the presumption that everybody born in the United States is a U.S. citizen, becomes a U.S. citizen. And the problems that would be created by a ruling that changes that presumption are just very many and varied. They would occur at all levels of government. It would be a particular problem for state and local governments to make these determinations about people's parents and where their parents are from and whether they were here legally or not here legally. It would be a huge mess, and I think it's the kind of thing that we may find a couple justices are willing to say they'd be willing to take on,
But
but
no.
I'd really be surprised if it gets more traction than that.
Yeah, by the way, our questions of the day, what cases are you most concerned about or invested in? What do you think the most consequential cases are? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Let me bring in a caller. We have, before we go to the break, Craig from Morganville is on the line. Craig, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have two real fast. The birthright thing should have never happened in the first place, but now we can't let it but not happen. If the two parents are illegal and the child is born here, what if the two parents get deported? What happens to that child? Now it's a burden of our country. That's my comment on that. The other one is, no matter what case goes forth, whether it was abortion or any landmark case, somehow in the arguments, the justices somehow find some little esoteric error that gets uncovered, which prevents from the common sense ruling that should be okay. And I think the attorneys on both sides are in error, thinking that the justices are supposed to be there for the common sense of the people. What the justices are really there for is the proper interpretation of the exact law, and these attorneys do not go through with a fine-tooth comb what issues could be happening as we argue this case, because so many times rulings are changed because they find some other issue amidst the argument. And that's the problem. It's not the justices, it's the attorneys.
Well,
They
thank
don't
you. Thank you.
anticipate this.
That's Craig from Morganville, his thought on that. A lot of people feel that way, that a lot of times there's big issues presented before the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court finds a technicality to not rule on that big issue. We've seen that happen multiple times. When we come back from the break, we're about to go to a break. We're going to talk about the two decisions about Trump versus Slaughter and Trump versus Cook that could determine whether presidents can gain sweeping authority over agencies that have historically been insulated from politics. We'll talk about those cases, mail-in ballots. There's a few others on the list. you have a thought, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court this hour and all the decisions we're expecting in the coming days ahead of the July 4th, which usually marks the end of the term. And there are a lot of opinions still on the docket. We have two guests with us explaining the cases, the arguments, and where the court is likely to land. We have Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, and Truman Capote, fellow for creative writing and law at Yale Law School. We also have Josh Gerstein, legal affairs correspondent for Politico. And we'd love to hear from you. What cases are you most concerned about or invested in? And what do you think the most consequential cases are? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook viewers, you can comment in the live chat. We have Lobster on YouTube who says the Supreme Court has given Trump the rubber stamp. What happens to the confines being the voice of the people? Dry Molasses on YouTube says, deeply concerned about birthright citizenship, not just for the concept itself, but also because of the potential fallout it has regarding drawing the line for who is a citizen or can become one. And so I want to move on now to the two cases, the Trump versus Slaughter and the Trump versus Cook cases that deal with whether presidents can fire someone who works at an independent agency. And these cases aren't, you know, household names, but they are among the most important of this term. And so, Emily, could you just tell us about these cases and why they are so important?
Well, Rebecca Slaughter was a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission, appointed by a previous president, still serving her term. And Trump fired her and said he has the power to do that, even though the statute that created the FTC that Congress passed in 1935 says that FTC commissioners serve unless they can be fired for cause, which is defined as like you're not doing your job, basically neglect or malfeasance. And the question is whether that enacting statute means what it seems to say, and also whether the Supreme Court still thinks that it represents a constitutional separation of powers. The direction the conservative majority has been moving in the last few years is to basically question whether Congress can insulate federal agencies from partisan politics by having these kinds of for cause requirements for firing commissioners. And, you know, basically what's at stake here is, are you going to have bipartisan leadership of federal agencies, or is each president going to get to start over, wipe the slate clean, and enact his agenda or her agenda by appointing all the people who lead the FTC and a whole bunch of other agencies? So that's what's going on in the FTC case. Mm-hmm. And then there's a companion case, as you mentioned, which has to do with the Federal Reserve. And in this case, Trump tried to fire one of the board of governors of the Fed, Lisa Cook, and he said he was doing it for cause. And this is supposed to be a better legal argument. The problem is that this allegation against Lisa Cook that is that she committed mortgage fraud. Nobody's ever proved it in court or even, you know, brought it to court. And so here you had a lot of skepticism at the argument from the justices. They were saying, okay, well, if the president says that he's firing someone based on allegations, do we have any power to review that? Does he have to meet any kind of standard of proof? Because if he can kind of just like make it up, then basically the Fed, you can get fired from the Fed really without cause. And so here, those are these two cases that both are really examples of Trump trying to expand the limits of presidential power and the court going back and looking at these statutes that Congress enacted when it established the agencies and saying, okay, like how do these claims square?
And so is there a constitutional distinction or a legal distinction between the FTC and the Federal Reserve such that there could be differing opinions or rulings with regard to these two cases?
I mean, maybe. So far, we just have one sentence in an emergency docket ruling from the court saying the Fed is different, but not for very convincing reasons. And so If, as many people expect, the court says Trump did have the power to fire the FTC commissioner, but not Lisa Cook, then they're going to have to do some, kind of, we'll see, some moves to explain why they are treating the Fed differently from the other agencies. I think there is reason to think this court just doesn't think that the president should have total say over monetary policy, that it would be quite destabilizing if the president can just sweep all of the all of the Fed commissioners away like pieces on a chessboard. And so maybe they'll make up or come up with some historical reason why the Fed is different, but it's going to be a challenge to make that historically accurate and really persuasive, I would argue.
Yeah, let's bring in another caller. We have Anish from Cherry Hill on the line. Anish, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, guys. Good afternoon. I love the show. I think that the Supreme Court is going to grant Trump at least broad powers to control who is a longtime federal employee, because, and they're doing this now because the elections are coming up. And as we all presume, there's going to be a large swing in the Democratic direction, hopefully, come November. And I think that the more Republicans he has in government power, the higher likelihood there is that he's going to claim that there was election irregularities, fraud, and it's going to be a chance for him to discount results or discount votes. That is my suspicion as to why they're pushing this case forward now.
Yeah, thank you. That's Anish from Cherry Hill giving his thoughts on this. Before we pivot to the next case, Josh, got to ask you, what would government look like if presidents could just gain full control over these types of independent agencies, and every single time someone new got elected, they could wipe everyone out and start over, kind of like Emily said, wipe the chessboard clean and install new people?
Well, it already is pretty close to being the case because of all the emergency rulings that we were talking about that happened last year. With the exception of Lisa Cook at the Federal Reserve, and I think maybe one other instance involving a fairly obscure official, the administration allowed Trump to fire people from all these sorts of posts. It's an alphabet soup of agencies. Most of them date to sort of the FDR New Deal era that have traditionally, we keep calling them independent agencies. If the president can basically remove and remake them at will, they're no longer independent. And then just to pick up on something that last caller mentioned, there's also a big legal fight going on that hasn't really quite reached the Supreme Court about the president's power over the whole layer of officials sort of below these leaders. We've seen the Trump administration taking unprecedented steps to fire people who are senior level prosecutors at the Justice Department, who are immigration judges, for example, to fire FBI agents, and claiming that the reason they're fired is not because of any specific misconduct, because the president said so that they should be fired. And this is a real challenge to the civil service that sort of staffs so many agencies across the government at the levels below these leaders. So we're talking about the administration taking on not just claiming the power to overturn who all the leaders of the agencies are, but actually to sort of sift through the staff and fire people that are not considered politically loyal. And that's really a power. While many administrations have claimed the power to change leadership at agencies, the power to sort of dismiss civil servants at will is not one that I'm familiar with any administration in my lifetime claiming they had the authority to do. And that's one of the big fights that I think we're going to see coming to the Supreme Court probably in its next term.
Wow, lots of battles over power here. So the court is now considering challenges that could reshape how elections are administered. And so we got to talk about the mail ballots case and why this case is so significant. Emily, could you talk a little bit about this mail-in ballots case, how it could impact voters and specifically military, overseas voters? So many people could be impacted by this decision.
Yeah, this is the case. Interestingly, it comes from Mississippi, and Mississippi has a law that says that you can't have to put your ballot, your mail-in ballot, in the mail by election day. But if it arrives after election day, there's like a several day grace period where it can still be counted. And so the question is, as presented to the Supreme Court, is whether that is constitutional, or rather, really, I should say, whether it comports with a statute that the Congress passed in the 19th century, naming election day as the day of the election. So the challengers to this Mississippi law are saying if your ballot gets there after Election Day, well, that isn't Election Day anymore. We don't have an election period. We still have an election day. I think that is a lot of weight to be putting on the words Election Day in this statute. And one of the issues that came up at our argument was, well, what about early voting? Because that's not on election day either, but it's something that we've had in the country for decades now, along with mail-in voting. And you're right, Cherry. I mean, more and more people vote by mail. There has traditionally been a kind of grace period for ballots to get returned, especially for military and overseas voters, because, their ballots are coming from a long way away. And I think there's a couple of questions here. One is this legal question. Is it up to the Supreme Court to say that states cannot extend more time to voters? Right? I mean, that's just a question about the statute, how it reads, what the court's job is. Then I think there's another question about whether it's a good idea or not for states to have these kinds of grace periods. And that one, like maybe policy-wise, you can argue both ways. You can say, well, it's helpful for getting more people to vote. Or you can say, you know what? As long as we make it clear ahead of time that the ballots have to actually arrive by election day, that's fine. Voters will understand that. And maybe these grace periods have, outlived their use. But that's really a policy question that normally you would want to leave to legislators as opposed to judges.
And so we'll see if the court weighs in on this. And so we want to get through a couple more cases. So, Josh, I got to ask you about the campaign finance case that could have major implications, the National Republican Senatorial Committee versus FEC case. Could you tell us quickly about this and the impact that this ruling could have?
Right. So this is a case that basically is about the amount of money that national political parties are allowed to spend in connection with House and Senate candidates. So it's a pretty arcane issue in that respect, but it's part of this battle that's been going on in recent years between these independent political groups and the political parties. People may have noticed, it means more and more ads on television being run by outside groups. Some people call them dark money groups. That have names on them that are not either, say, the Pennsylvania Democratic Party or Republican Party or the National Republican or Democratic Party, but the Coalition for American Values or something along those lines, which merely makes you scratch your head at where it's coming from. So you have here the Republican Party trying to say, we believe we should be allowed to spend more money in connection with our candidates rather than having to essentially set up all kinds of arrangements to keep the candidates at arm's length. My understanding from our sort of more political folks at Politico, since I'm more of the legal folks, is that this ruling, if it comes out in the NRSC's favor, would generally favor Republicans more, but it would also probably give both Republican Party and the Democratic Party more of a role in those congressional campaigns and probably beef up their involvement in campaigns a little bit and probably dial back somewhat of these independent expenditure groups that we've seen pop up over the last couple decades. We should say mainly because as a result of Supreme Court rulings that basically said that it's impossible to regulate those groups from or prevent them from running these sorts of advertising.
Yeah, a lot of big cases. And so we only have 2.5 minutes left in this segment, but I want to ask you, what other big case are you following? If you were to put your finger on it, you say of the dozen or so remaining, which one besides the ones we've talked about are you keeping your eye on and that you think will have the biggest impact, Emily?
I think the case about asylum and what's called metering at the border of asylum claims is hugely significant for how presidential administrations regulate the border. This is a power that the Biden administration claimed to basically limit the number of people who can claim asylum on any one day. And the Trump administration has continued that policy. And it's a really interesting set of questions. It's a conservative Supreme Court, so they may well rule in favor of, allowing presidents to limit the right to asylum at the border. We shall see, but I'm watching that with a lot of interest.
Yeah, a lot of restrictions on immigration. Is there a case that you're keeping your eye on, Josh, that you think will have a major impact?
Well, there are some other immigration cases that are definitely going to have an impact on hundreds of thousands of people that have the temporary protected status. But I think the outcome of those cases is pretty much clear that they're not going to come down in the favor of the immigrants involved. I'd say the main case that I would watch in addition to this list, there's one out of Hawaii that has to do with where people can carry their weapons. And I think it's a very interesting case about sort of this collision between private property and people's gun rights. We generally think of people that are very strongly in favor of private property as being sort of the same people maybe who are very strongly in favor of gun rights. But we have a clash basically about whether you can bring your gun into private businesses, say in a shopping mall or something along those lines, or whether you need the permission in advance from a business owner. People obviously spend a lot of their day going to and from private businesses. And I think it's a really interesting case that will dictate in many states whether people can really go around in public armed in any setting other than outdoors, or whether they're really going to have a lot of difficulty doing that. Because most store owners, whatever they may say, are not very interested in having people inside their business with a firearm. And
That's for
so
sure.
it'll be an interesting case to see how that comes out.
That is for sure. Thank you so much. That voice is the voice of Josh Gerstein, legal affairs correspondent for Politico. We also heard from Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thanks to you, Emily and Josh, for your commentary today. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Cherry.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who called in and wrote in today. And of course, we have to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks, Satina Calique, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Also, shout out to him for doing the chat with me earlier. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.